But no, that is
good. I'd
like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. We have two public hearings and two work sessions, and I know Senator Roblin and Representative McCune are going to be coming and wanted to testify first. But since they're not here yet, there she is.
Here she comes.
We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 279A.
We have others with us. May I invite them up?
We're just going to take your and Arnie's testimony first, then we're going to go back through and do some work sessions and come back to the bill.
Okay, great. Perfect. I'm happy to begin.
Because I know you had someplace else to be, I think.
One or two other places. Chair Holby, thank you for your courtesy. I appreciate it very much. Are we official?
We are live. We have opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 279A. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Kattie McHugh, and I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, which includes Winchester Bay, which is the location that where this bill comes from. It's from a constituent of mine and Senator Roblin's. Chair Holby, members of the committee, I thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. For a little background, in 2001, House Bill 2867 added clarification to the unpaid wages claim process by balancing the penalty compensation an employee can receive against the amount of the unpaid wage claim if the claim is responded to promptly. That means within 12 days. Senator. House Bill 2867 was an attempt to not only protect employees but also incentivize employers to settle unpaid wage claims quickly. The creation of the 12-day window was a new addition to the framework, and it's come to the small businesses community's attention that many truly small business owners are not aware of the 12-day 100% cap window. Senate Bill 279 before you is in direct response to a matter involving a constituent of the senators in mine, a small business owner in Winchester Bay, and would require that written notice of an unpaid wage claim include a statement regarding the payment for final wages. This allows for employees to seek penalty compensation should their final wages not be paid in full. Also notifies the employers that responding rapidly to these claims is in their best interest. And Senate Bill 279 also leaves fully intact the option for an employee to seek increased compensation should their claim not be settled within that 12-day window. But 279 is engrossed as a good bill that brings clarification to the protocol for implementing final payment of employee wages by keeping protections for employees intact while ensuring that small business owners are notified of their rights under current law. This kind of communication is critical to the truly small businesses and owners, particularly in rural communities like ours, who may not otherwise be aware of statutory changes like those created by House Bill 2687, which was a good bill. It sought to increase protections by urging employees employers to compensate employees appropriately for their time, while at the same time putting incentives in place for the employers to do so in a timely manner and to do so quickly. Senator Roblin has worked very closely with our constituents, so I think I'll stop there and let Senator Roblin tell you the story that actually brought this to us. And hopefully you can see this as a simple fix to a problem that I think actually benefits employees and employers.
And thank you, Chair Holby and committee, for the opportunity to speak here. Senator Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5, Coos Bay, Tillamook Bay. We have a small business in Winchester Bay, which is between Reedsport and Coos Bay, at the mouth of the Umpqua River, actually. And it's a beautiful little community, and this lady has this little restaurant. Yeah, it's mostly a bread shop, but you can buy coffee and stuff and stop by. And a lot of us do. My staffers stop by all the time, as you know, Rosie. And so when this thing came up, this particular issue, she got a notification, and she wasn't sure exactly what to do about it. And she's tried making sure that she did the right kinds of things. And all of a sudden she finds out that, wow, there's the possibility she's going to get this huge fine because she didn't do something wrong. So she actually went out and got an attorney who turned out to be, when you live in small communities, people you know, and one of those people who's been a public defender in our area for a long time. And he came to me. They went to court. She won. She had done the things, and she tried to respond as quickly as she could, and it worked out. But she said, I was just really shook up. I'm a small business person trying to do the right things, and all of a sudden I get in this deal that looked like it was kind of a trap to get more money for lawyers. I don't know what the issue was. And so her attorney came and talked to us and said, you know, there should be just a little clarification. I don't want to change the rule. I just want to make it clear to people, including those people who are wages, that are employers, especially the small ones, that they understand they better act on this quickly because they have a responsibility to it. So instead of just putting down in the notice how much money you were expected to be paid or a way in which you can figure out how much you're going to be paid, we also want a statement in there that says if you don't pay within 12 days, you run a risk of having a much larger fine because of unwillingness to pay. I thought that was a pretty simple clarification, easy language. We put it in, and all of a sudden, a number of people came to our office, who I have also respected with respect to labor, saying that this is really going to make it a lot harder for the employer and employee if he just wants to write a note to the person, because now he's got this requirement that not only does he or she have to list how much money they're owed, or at least a way in which they could figure out how much she's owed, they also had to make a notice that it had this 12-day, and if they fleffed that out, it could really be a problem, because as all of the statute is written, if the notice is incorrectly sent, you lose the right to do it. So then I heard, well, I understand that, but we're going to be very clear about what it looks like. We need to make sure that everybody understands. You need to put up, not only do you need to put in what your expected wages are, you also need to write a statement that says XYZ. They said, well, they're probably only going to get one shot at this. So you will also have in the record, because we had it submitted to you, legislative counsel opinion that it doesn't have anything to do with that. They can try to do it as many times as they need to. The reality is there is nothing in the statute that indicates it. So their opinion is that if you file it wrong the first time, file it better the next time. And at each time, the deadline starts, that 12 days deadline starts when they get the appropriate message or letter to them. So we're not trying to change that. We're not trying to let people off the hook because they haven't paid employees the wages there are. We're just trying to make it a system that is clear both to the employee and to the employer what their responsibilities are. We don't think it does anything else than that. And I've looked at some of the other amendments. I'm a little concerned that making lists and other things doesn't help this situation at all, because I really truly believe in many of the cases that I think exist out there, and there aren't that many of them that I know of, the small business person is feeling just as uptight about the court thing and not doing the right thing as the other person is. Even if they parted in not such good ways, which sometimes happens, that has nothing to do with this. This has to do with work I've done, I get to get paid for. I absolutely agree with that, believe it's the right thing to do. I think this bill makes clear that to the employer that they are going to have some other fines to pay if they don't pay that, and now I think both sides enter into this situation appropriately. So to me, the bill as we have gotten it here to you is the right bill, and I would love to have you support that. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. And again, from my perspective as a representative, I represent all the people. I've always loved my labor people, but I also love my small business people that make available to jobs, and I just want both sides to feel that they're being treated fairly. And I think this bill does that.
And Chair Holvey, if you ever come through Winchester Bay, stop at the Sourdough Bakery. You will enjoy it, I promise.
Oh, it's a weakness.
And if any of you are surfers, it's the greatest surfing spot on the coast. It's right there.
And they grow great oysters.
Yeah. Oh, I love those, too. Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. Are there questions for this? We have a list of people to testify on this further as well. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, you are for the base bill, and you oppose
the love the base. Two. I think the base bill is the appropriate one if there's...
And I concur. The base bill is really where we'd like to go.
Yeah.
All right.
With the amendments that we put when we were over there. We really worked hard to try to find that
version.
Place. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you for bringing this forward. We'll definitely have a conversation with this, though I do note that we're going to come back to this bill a little bit later. We're going to go through some work sessions, make sure we get our business done. So, and there was some people that wanted to testify that couldn't be here until a little later anyway. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 279, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 336.
Mr. Chair. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that you heard on May 8th. It allows a construction contractor or business to temporarily operate without a responsible managing individual. The amendment was drafted after the public hearing. That's the -2 amendment. It requires the contractor to notify the construction contractors board immediately when an RMI ceases to hold that role. It requires the notification to include the name and address of the qualified employee who will step into the RMI position, or when there's not a qualified person, they will name a temporary RMI. It allows the business or the contractor to operate with a temporary RMI for up to 14 days while that person is being credentialed. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal expenditure impact on the -2 amendment.
So if I could get Jim come up, and I don't know if the AGC would like to come up and comment on it. I know you haven't had an opportunity, perhaps, to comment on the amendment. If you wish, you may. Not exactly a public hearing, but, you know, thought it appropriate for you to be able to say something about it. So, because I haven't talked to you about the amendment. So,
so they're not limited to 14.
So,
14 or 2.
So, Jim, could you briefly, Jan already kind of went through the amendment, if you could just sort of explain to us what the thinking in this amendment is.
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Jim Denno from the Construction Contractors Board. The amendment addressed our concerns about, and your concerns, frankly, about there not being any RMI for a period of time. So, what this will require is the immediate appointment of either a qualified RMI or a temporary RMI, and then 14 days to get a properly credentialed RMI on board. That's the gist of the amendment. That's the gist of the bill, and it fixes the problem that we intended to try and fix.
And just to be clear, subsequent to that, there's nothing that prevents a company from changing RMIs.
No.
At any point in time either,
no.
Is there?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to check on that. So thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, if you'd like to say something.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Kirsten Adams with Associated General Contractors. And I'll keep it simple. We support the -2 amendment, and we're glad that this will be a change that's happening. So.
All right.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this group? Before I take Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the amendment, we have a contractor business may operate with a temporary responsible managing individual for the earlier of 14 days after giving the notification or until the date in which the contractor business receives notice that the board has approved an individual. So is this saying that they're still limited to 14 days, or are they saying if no one has been so what happens after the 14 days, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Do you want me to?
Go ahead. I think you're the expert. I could answer that, but I would prefer that you do.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, the 14 days is the upper limit that you can operate without a properly credentialed RMI. And intended to give you a certain amount of time, a limited amount of time, to get that person trained and tested with the agency.
And I think his question was more what happens if there isn't one appointed, because I think currently if you don't have an RMI, something happens. And, you know, after 14 days, I think is what his question was.
That's correct, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto. So we would take enforcement action at that point, issue a notice of intent to suspend the license and go through the due process.
Yeah. So thank you very much for enlightening us a little bit, and be happy to take a motion on the amendment.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 336.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 336. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 336 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 336 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Jordy?
Aye.
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hatch?
Aye.
Representative
Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 336 is passed. Shall we have a carrier on this one? Representative Hack, thank you. Willing volunteers.
No problem.
That'll close a work session on Senate Bill 336 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1028.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that you heard on Monday. It authorizes professional licensing boards to consider and to substitute relevant experience for the high school diploma or the equivalent education requirement. No amendment. No revenue or expenditure impact. Right. Senate vote was 29-0.
Thank you. And do we have a motion on this?
Yeah. Chair Holby, I move what number? 1020. Senate Bill 1028 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves Senate Bill 1028 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Jordy?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 1028, having received the votes, is passed. And Representative Bynum would like to carry that one.
Mr. Chair, as a co-chief sponsor, may I carry that?
Do you have any objections? No. Didn't know you were a co-chief sponsor. Must be a recent addition.
It is.
But certainly we'll change the carrier to Representative Hurd.
Thank you.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 1028, and let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 299A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the first time you're hearing about this bill. It comes to you from the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Clarifies that the employer may limit an employee to accruing 40 hours of sick time per year. Clarifies the employer may adopt policy that limits the employee to accruing no more than 80 hours in a year and using no more than 40 hours in a year. Excludes certain individuals from the count of employees. Modifies the rate of pay for accrued sick leave for employees that are paid on a piece rate or a commission basis. Provides that employers' time off policy need not comply with sick time requirements beyond the first 40 hours that the employer's policy provides per year. It applies to hours worked and sick time accrued or used after January 1, 2018, and there's an emergency clause. The Dash 4 amendment defines substantial ownership interest at 15% as opposed to 10% that is in the A engrossed bill. There's no revenue impact and there's no expenditure impact on the A4 amendment.
Thank you. And let's sign up sheet. Let's bring forward Jenny Dressler and Kristen Adams and Paloma Sparks. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here to speak on Senate Bill 299. If you could enlighten us as to what this bill is all about.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to come before you and testify in support of Senate Bill 299A and the Dash 4 amendments today.
For the record, my name is Jenny Dressler with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We represent about 7,000 farming and ranching families in the state of Oregon and 65,000 members statewide. We are here today after working with Bully and other stakeholders on what we hope is the compromise bill that moves forward for the rest of the session. Senate Bill 299A is the result of work in the interim around rulemaking with regard to the sick time law. Certain provisions were not made clear in the statute that were expressed pretty clearly on the floor in both the House and the Senate when the bill passed in 2015. It was Senate Bill 454. And these provisions are going to help small businesses implement this law. Our folks have been working for the past couple of years to get into compliance, and we believe that these clarifications will help us get there at the end of the day. So the bill includes, as you heard, to us, four key provisions or four key clarifications. The first is around employer location. Currently, within the statute, it is not clear that a seasonal farm stand that is located outside of Portland on a permanent basis, so maybe Albany and you're growing vegetables, but you sell into Portland temporarily through a farm stand or a farmer's market. Right now, those folks are under the Portland sick time threshold of 6 employees or more, as opposed to the Oregon sick time threshold of 10 employees or more. So this clarifies that they are not actually located in Portland. They're located outside of the Portland area and fall under that threshold. I'm going to skip the employee count piece and come back to that because that's where the amendment comes into play. Piece rate clarifications, it was made clear in both the Senate and the House when Senate Bill 454 passed that piece rate could be paid at the state minimum wage unless the worker already had a stated hourly, weekly or monthly wage. So for us, that might be pruning at $13 an hour. But unless that worker has another wage at their place of business, then they can be paid the state minimum wage. For us, this was more about workforce availability and making sure that we can get crops out of the ground on time and that we have those folks available. And so that provision just clarifies that legislative intent as it was expressed on the floor. We used the terminology regular rate of pay in the bill, but didn't realize that it cross-referenced, and Bully can speak to this, but didn't realize that it cross-referenced Bully rules with regard to the terminology regular rate of pay. First 40 hours, this was a provision that I know matters to a lot of the business groups who have been engaged in the rulemaking process. This also clarifies legislative intent, which was that the first 40 hours of a paid time off policy would be those protected hours under the sick time law. Beyond that, those hours are not protected. That actually gives employers the flexibility to create a more generous paid time off policy, is what we believe, if all of those 80 hours or however many hours that they provide were protected. I think you would see employers a lot less willing to engage in more robust paid time off policies. And the final provision for you all on the amendment today, the dash fours, are around the employee count. Again, legislative intent on, I believe, both the Senate and the House floors clarified that family members were not included in the employee count for qualifying for paid versus unpaid sick leave. So paid sick leave for Oregon sick time is a threshold of 10 employees or more. For Portland, 6 employees or more, and then unpaid is below that. Both are protected leaves. It's just whether or not that leave is paid or not. The family member exemption was intended to lessen the burden on, I think, family businesses, small businesses. In agriculture, we are predominantly multi-generational family operations. I know a lot of other small businesses are as well. And so this actually matters a lot because a lot of folks are on that cusp of 9 to 12, depending on how you count. So the provision that you have in front of you in this bill is an attempt to try to align the family member exemption with legislative intent. So we looked at unemployment insurance and then workers' compensation and how they count family members, borrowed from both of those, but particularly the substantial ownership threshold under workers' compensation. And then I know that some folks still thought that it might be too broad with that floor of a 10% ownership being an actual ownership interest. And so we negotiated with the chair and others in our coalition to look at a 15% threshold, which would be the equivalent, I believe, if my math is right, and I am not a mathematician, but would be the equivalent of 6 equal equal part business owners in an LLC or an S-Corp. And so that could be a family of six individuals, which we have a lot of those in agriculture. You would not make it to seven equal owners. That would be under that threshold, and then nobody would be counted as a business owner if they were all equal owners. So I appreciate the work everybody has done and the opportunity to testify, and I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Adams with Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. We support Senate Bill 299 and in particular Section 1, Subsection 3B, and that's a piece that Jenny spoke about about employer location. It also specifies that a construction trailer used for office purposes doesn't constitute an employer location. And this is important to our industry, given that the construction industry is highly mobile, moving from location to location as contractors complete jobs on different sites. So without this clarification, there's confusion about whether sick leave should be paid or unpaid, making compliance and the use of sick leave more difficult. So we believe that the clarification in this bill will clear up that confusion, and we support the bill. So if you have any questions, please let me know.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As Jenny and Kirsten mentioned, we worked closely together on rulemaking after the 2015 session and during the 2016 interim. We did our best in rulemaking to clarify any issue areas or any areas where there was confusion. There were several places in the statute that the language was very clear. For instance, with piece rate, it said that an employee who's paid on a piece rate basis will be paid their regular rate of pay unless they don't have a regular rate of pay. Piece rate is a regular rate of pay in longstanding wage and hour law. So that was sort of, that language was complicated and it was hard to clear up by relying on the record. So we would prefer to have this clear in the statute. We worked really closely together with the Oregon Farm Bureau to get this language right. Similarly, there was no indication in the language and limited record and certainly insufficient to interpret on the 40 hours of the PTO plan, but I think that was probably the intent. So we're clearing up that. on the counting employees, the language didn't really take into account the differing ways that business structure are structured. The existing statutory language says that individuals who are employed by that individual's parent, spouse, or child are excluded from the definition of employee. That's pretty complicated, and if you read that the way we have, the courts and we have always interpreted that, a corporation can't be an individual's parent, spouse, or child. So that existing exemption only applies to sole proprietorships. This language makes it so that same sort of exclusion couldn't extend to corporations and limited liability partnerships and limited liability companies. The one sort of real new piece that isn't necessarily really attached to what was Senate Bill 454 from 2015 are the pieces about the temporary farm stands and temporary construction trailers in Portland, excluding them from the definition of maintaining a location in Portland. Otherwise, it's mostly cleanup. There were a couple areas where the language wasn't clear. There was an exemption about work-study students that there was a typo. There's just a word missing, so we fixed that. There was some language that was hard to read for some folks to comply with the law, so we've cleaned that up. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Gosh, I have one.
And I
just want for clarification, because I had some concern about the temporary construction trailers and what constitutes a temporary construction trailer. And I was, to be honest, I was a little uncomfortable with proceeding the way the bill was written because it seemed sort of vague. After discussing it with all of you, am comfortable but feel like I need to say, you know, I want to make sure that you just don't park a trailer on a lot somewhere and it's all of a sudden a place of business. It has to have, you know, it's a temporary, you know, idea that it's there, but there's got to be some activity. In other words, you just can't park something there and have it just sitting there and just for the purpose of saying this is our temporary location. So I know that Bowley, you know, after talking to you, that there's a lot of nuances to that and a lot of different circumstances that you'll address those specifics and rule.
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
So, okay. So just thank you very much. I also have up to testify Kate Newell and Sandra Hernandez.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today with Family Forward. I'm happy to be here today to testify on Senate Bill 299 and the amendments to Oregon's paid sick time law. I do appreciate the work that has been done on Senate Bill 299A over on the Senate side that moved us from a place of opposition to a position of neutral on the bill. We believe that the changes address all of the issues that we have been discussing frequently and in multiple work groups since the passage of sick time in 2015. As you know, Family Forward worked with many others to pass a strong and inclusive paid sick time law for Oregon workers. The law is meant to ensure that workers are able to take time off when they or a family member are ill and is an important public health measure and a basic right to which all workers should be entitled. We did work hard to craft a law that works well for employers and employees alike and have always been open to truly technical changes. But we have certainly been opposed when we see changes that come to the sick time law that propose rolling back or eliminating protections for any worker in Oregon. I think this has been a careful balance and a subject of much discussion over the past two years. While we don't object to the changes in Senate Bill 299 and the proposed A4 amendments, we do want to be clear in the limitations that these changes are placing on employees' access to paid sick time in several important instances. As you just mentioned, Chair Holvey, we do share a concern about the inclusion of temporary locations. I think that the intent is to exclude from this definition locations that are truly temporary in nature. When this issue came up through rulemaking in the fall of 2016, we suggested putting a time limitation on what could be considered temporary so that you couldn't have something like a food cart, for example, that is definitely a temporary structure, but permanently in one location counting as temporary. So we do think this provision would be better if it had a set time limit around it. On the exemption for LLC owners and their family members, when we originally discussed the exemption for business owners, we certainly did not envision LLCs, and it was more about a particular family and one business owner. But extending this exemption to LLCs, we think is acceptable because it does set a percentage ownership threshold on how much a family has to own of the LLC. Our concern around adding LLCs was really we didn't want somebody to be able to add an infinite number of employees as LLC members and then have all of them exempted from the who counts as an employee. So we do really appreciate the ownership percentage threshold on that and think it does prevent it from being abused. Related to the piece rate employees and the wages due for sick time, I think it has been argued that the legislative intent around piece rate workers was they get paid the minimum wage when they're out on sick time. But I think this only conveys sort of part of the story in my mind. I think it's important to note that when legislators were having conversations around what a piece rate worker should earn when they take sick time, we all assumed that piece rate workers didn't actually have a regular rate of pay. And I think the thought was you wanting to ensure that they get something while they're out on sick time. When those conversations and negotiations were happening, we didn't realize that there had been a long-established principle in wage and hour law about what a regular rate of pay is for a piece rate employee. And it's essentially the average wage that they would have earned for all of the hours that they worked when looking back over that period of time. But we do acknowledge that this was very much what that legislators were thinking in passing the paid sick time legislation, but do just want to flag that it will mean that workers out on sick time will be getting less than what their regular pay rate is if they're a piece rate employee. Section 3 and the limitations on a PTO policy used to satisfy sick time requirements. I think this piece, it was always the intent that you are only able to take sick time for the first 40 hours of a combined PTO sick time policy. So basically, and it took a minute for this one to really gel in my mind what it was meaning. But if you are an employer who gives a more generous PTO policy that also counts for sick time, for example, you give a PTO policy that's 60 hours in a year, and then your employee decides to take 40 hours of PTO in January for a vacation, that employee now at this point has exhausted all of their paid sick time and won't be able to, well, they'll have 20 hours remaining in their PTO bank. The employer does not have to allow that remaining 20 hours to be used for protected sick time purposes. And the last couple changes, we don't have any rewording done in Section 2. I think this was primarily cleanup to make it read clear. We don't actually think that it changes anything in how the law applies and how much sick time a worker can accrue. And we also don't have any objections to the language in Section 4 and changes the definition of payroll for purposes of workers' comp law and sick time. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts on Senate Bill 299. As one of the driving coalition partners behind the new sick time law, we do want to make sure that the law remains strong and at the same time make sure that technical corrections are addressed. We do appreciate, having the opportunity to work on Senate Bill 299 with its proponents and get to a place where we don't have objections to it. So thanks for that, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Chair Halvey and members of the House Business and Labor Committee, my name is Sandra Hernandez, and I am here on behalf of PECUN on Senate Bill 299A. PECUN was part of the coalition that worked to pass paid sick time in 2015. We represent over 6,000 farm workers around Oregon and work to empower farm workers across the state. PECUN was an active part of the paid sick time coalition and believed that farm workers, just like any other worker, have a fundamental right to paid sick time. We have also fought against efforts to exempt farm workers or weaken sick time protections for this one class of workers. Unfortunately, these hardworking individuals are often left out of major labor protections, and we want to ensure that this is not the case in Oregon. While we were originally opposed to SB 299A, we appreciate the amendments made in the Senate, and we are now neutral on the bill. We do want to point out that this bill focuses exclusively on farm workers and their ability to use and be paid on sick time. We want to make sure that legislators realize that paid sick time has been essential protection for farm workers across Oregon, and we want to make sure that workers are not singled out for lesser protections than provided to other workers. We have always been open to truly technical changes in the law, but want to be very careful that in making technical changes, we don't undermine or erode these protections. We believe protecting sick time for farm workers is essential. Farm workers should not fear losing their jobs or putting food on the table simply for being ill. We also believe that it is fundamental that there is a public health protection. Farm workers handle food, and if they're sick and they're working, you know, this could be potentially spreading to the population. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 299. Please keep farm workers on your mind and think about the labor that they provide around the state and how fundamental their work is to our economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Do we have questions, this panel? Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 299A, and let's open a work session on Senate Bill 299A to adopt the amendment.
Chair Halvey, I move to adopt the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 299.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 299. Discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. And we're going to carry this bill over till when?
The 31st.
So with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 299A and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 279A. So this is the bill that Representative Catty McEwen and Senator Arlene Roblin testified on. So let's start out with Anthony Smith. And we may not get through this entire public hearing, so I'm anticipating that it will also come back. Hopefully we'll get a few more people to testify, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony K. Smith. I'm the state director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 7,000 Oregon small businesses, many being the smallest of small businesses, including the small business NFIB member that our chief sponsors of this bill mentioned in their prior testimony. And I'm happy to be here today to talk about this issue. I think I'll start just briefly talking about how this bill came about. I got a phone call from Nancy last year explaining, Nancy Faubel is the NFIB member and constituent of the chief sponsors. She called me up and told me what was going on and that she had hired an attorney and that she was facing a wage claim case. She thought she had done nothing wrong. She had kept meticulous records, and it looked like she was going to have to go to court. And it was really a lose-lose situation for her because she was, 99% positive that she had done nothing wrong and was facing this demand letter of thousands and thousands of dollars. She knew that if she hired an attorney and it went to trial that she was also going to have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars, and so she just decided, well, if I'm going to be out either way, I'm going to fight this and stick up for myself, and hopefully we'll get the right outcome, and she did fortunately get the outcome that was that was agreeable to her, and so during the process, she and her attorney they brought this issue of this 2001 law, House Bill 2867 to light, and it should be noted that the attorney that defended her in her case is a local attorney down on the southern to central coast, and he's just as likely to represent an employee in a wage claim case as he is to defend an employer in a wage claim case. And since 2001, he's always been operating under the assumption of what we're trying to accomplish with Senate Bill 279. So when he sends a demand letter, he always includes in that demand letter, hey, you should probably take care of this within 12 days. Otherwise, you as the employer are facing a much larger potential penalty. So prior to 2001 and prior to the passage of House Bill 2867, an employee who had a wage claim was entitled to 30 days penalty wages if it was found that the wages were in fact owed. What they did with House Bill 2867 in 2001 was say, well, for an amount of maybe $10 of unpaid wages, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that a penalty could be applied that could be $2,000 or more. If you think about even minimum wage, 30 days pay is quite a lot. So that would be a very large penalty for a potentially low dollar number for unpaid wages. So in the wisdom of the legislature in 2001, they passed 2867, and what that did was it established that as long as the employer pays within 12 days of receiving a written notification of non-payment, that the penalty can't exceed 100% of the amount of the wages. So if it was a $10 amount of unpaid wages, a penalty of $10 would also be applied, and the employer would owe the employee a total of $20. So that was a good bill. That was the bill that was referenced in prior testimony. And the problem that came along, and what came to our attention, is that this can really only work when both parties are aware of the stakes. And so that's what Senate Bill 279 is intending to accomplish, is to basically, when and if a situation of unpaid wages escalates to the point where either bully's involved or attorneys are involved, when and if that employee thinks that they are ready to pursue a possible penalty, that when and if that situation arises, that the employer needs to be put on notice that they have 12 days to pay. That's the point of what we're trying to do here. It's about disclosure. It's about closing a little loophole in the 2001 law that says, and you can look on the bill here, the Senate Bill 279 is a two-page bill with one paragraph bold print. And you'll see in Section 1 goes over the 30-day penalty wage provisions. And then you'll see in Subsection 2 and I'll just read it right here. Subsection 2A, this is current law. If the employee or a person on behalf of the employee submits a written notification of non-payment, the penalty may not exceed 100% of the employee's unpaid wages or compensation unless the employer fails to pay the full amount of the employee's unpaid wages or compensation within 12 days after receiving the notice. Our assertion is that this can really only work as intended when both parties are aware of the law. And so that's what Senate Bill 279 seeks to do. It merely seeks to add another provision into the statute that a written notice of non-payment must include a statement that basically says what Subsection 2A says. So that's what we're trying to accomplish with this. And we think that if and when an employee is prepared to pursue a penalty, they've probably been advised of the fact that there are penalties out there that they may be entitled to. And so that would kind of beg the question, well, you know, if they're aware of the statute and there's already provisions in the statute, and you'll see that in subsection 2C of what qualifies a written notification of non-payment already, that an additional qualifier of what that written notification of non-payment needs to look like is not too much to ask, especially since we assume that the only reason that they would be interested in pursuing a penalty is if they were already, someone has advised them that there is a statute out there that allows for the pursuit of this penalty. So that's what we're trying to do with this bill. Nancy couldn't be here today. I know she wishes that she could be here today. She actually has a rabbi from Portland coming down to her location today to get kosher certified at her food processing facility. So she apologizes that she can't be here today, but I know she's might be watching, and she's very interested in the outcome of this bill. The last thing I'll say, and I know we're short on time, but the last thing I'll say is that I did have a chance to look at the Dash A2s, and although I appreciate the amount of interest in this bill, there's a couple reasons why I think those are problematic. And one is that the first provision that deals with making the disclosure requirement applicable to attorneys only and communications from attorneys. The problem there, and we went down this road when this bill was on the Senate side of trying to limit that disclosure requirement to attorneys only, is that in practice, effectively, and what the defense attorneys will tell you is that what will happen if that happens is that an employee will go to a plaintiff's attorney, tell them what's going on, say they're interested in pursuing this, and the plaintiff's attorney will say, well, okay, I can't send that for you right now. You need to send the notification to your employer on your own. And then on day 13, once they haven't responded, we'll send the demand letter. So that's what will happen in practice if the disclosure requirement is only limited to communications coming from an attorney. On top of that, there are other provisions in the Dash 2s that would require Boley to create a database of these of notices of non-payment, and the problem that we see there is twofold. One, it's not our intention for this bill to place any additional costs or duties on Boley. That's not what we're trying to do. And also, I think it's very problematic to create a government database of people who have only been accused of something. I don't think that sends the right message to small business, and so we would respectfully urge you to oppose those amendments and pass the bill, the A engrossed version of the bill, out of committee.
Thank you. Thank you. And Anthony, I know will be here next Wednesday, the 31st, and I have another gentleman in the audience who is signed up, and I'm not sure he can come back. It's David Shuck. And I got about 5 minutes left, and then we're just going to have to carry the rest of the public hearing over. So, Mr. Shuck, if you'd like to provide your testimony, because I don't know if you're able to come back next week or not. So I want to give you an opportunity, at least for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Board. My name is David Shuck. I'm an attorney. I'm an owner of Shuck Law. It's a four-attorney firm. We primarily do wage claims. We also do other employment claims, and we are located in Vancouver, but primarily work throughout the state. In fact, I'm going to Klamath Falls on a case after this. The problem, I'm completely opposed to the amendment at all. The problem with it is it's false.
The amendment or the bill?
The proposed amendment that's in the bill.
Okay.
Senate bill, 239? Sorry, I don't have my glasses on.
279.
279. It's false because it presumes that that's the only way that they could be held liable for the full amount. So if an attorney is writing that for their client, we're advising the other side of a false statement of the law. So I'm not only giving advice to the other side, but I'm also giving them incorrect advice. And here's why. There's an exception. So if the employer has violated 652.140 in the year preceding, they're liable for the entire 30 days anyway. So if you tell them that they're going to only have to pay a matching amount and they've already violated the law, you've just told them something that's false. And then they're going to, well, most likely file a bar complaint against me, but assuming that that's not at issue, they're going to go into court and say, look, we have a letter from the attorney that says this is all we're liable for. At least make it an admission so that the rest of the statute doesn't apply to me because they lied to me and told me that I would only have to pay this much. It doesn't make any sense. The statute is written. It's there for everyone. The other thing that's wrong with it is they're worried about small business, who the businesses are supposed to know the law. The employee isn't required to know the law and often doesn't. I can't tell you how many of my clients call me up and they've run into a problem. They've done everything they can and they can't seem to get the employer to pay them, no matter what they do. They've asked them 20 times over the phone. And I say, well, have you asked them in writing? And they say, well, I've texted them a few times and they told me that they're not going to pay me, and I've called them and I've done all these different things. They don't know that there's a statute out there that they have to tell them about the 12 days. They're actually less apt to know it than the employer, who is supposed to be up on the law. And so you're trying to protect a single, you know, the businesses, you're punishing the employees that the law is actually there to protect. The purpose of the penalties is to spur the employer to pay the wages. That's what the Supreme Court of Oregon said. That's why this was has been in the books, I don't know how long, since the 50s, I think, maybe sooner. You know, it's there to make them pay the wages, and the employees are calling up because, you know, they're unsophisticated, so they're calling their manager and saying, I want my wages, leave me alone, I want my wages. And I've had them come to me and say, well, they've told me that if I come back down there and ask for it again, they're going to call the police. I've asked them so many times, I need my wages to pay my rent. That's what we see. You know, is there potentially people out there that know what the law is, and they're you know, making the specific demand and could actually comply with this. Yeah, there are people who have sophistication who are employees. All the attorneys that work for me certainly could do it. And so there are people who could comply anyway, but these laws are out there to protect the least sophisticated employees out there who just want to get paid their wages. And these laws are set out to protect that right. So it's unfair, the testimony before me was that basically the employees, when they're writing these things, are aware of the stakes, and the employer is not. That's not true. In fact, I mean, I would almost go to the point of saying that most of my clients have asked for their wages verbally or by telephone multiple times before they ever call me, and they're not getting any response. The purpose of the writing is to make it seem more official, and then the employer will comply. But I mean, if they've been asked for their wages, then why aren't they paying it? It doesn't matter whether it was in writing or verbally. Why aren't they paying it? It's a choice of the employer. And you have to remember that under ORS 652-150, which they're seeking to amend, they're only liable for the penalty if their actions were willful. That means they have to have intended the actions that they were doing and been a free agent. And if they don't even know that the wages are due, they're not liable. So the other thing that I will...
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up because we're due on the floor in a few minutes. So.
Okay. I'll be very quick. First of all, the example that they gave, I believe Otla put in the paperwork, she did not win the entire case. She lost. She lost some of it and won a good portion of it. And she made a tactical decision to prosecute it and defend against it. And that was her choice. And so to say that she's absolutely innocent, that's not what was found. She was found that she owed wages, and that was the basis of the wage claim. She was found that she didn't owe overtime, and no attorney's fees were awarded.
Well, I hate to cut you off, but I think you've made some good points, and we're going to come back to this subject matter next Wednesday. I appreciate you being here to provide your testimony. And if you have something in writing, you're more than willing to submit that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. Colleagues, we'll carry over Senate Bill 279 to next Wednesday, as well as Senate Bill 299 as previously announced. Anything else, Jan?
That's it.
With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. House Committee on Business and Labor. I adjourn the